Today we have the opportunity to visit the witness stand again, an opportunity as a congregation where I select someone from the congregation to basically share their story, their testimony, how they came to know the Lord, and their life since. So today we have the privilege of having Heather McKenzie to the witness stand. So I call Heather McKenzie to the witness stand. Let's give her a greeting. How are you?
I am well.
Good. Glad to hear it. Have a seat.
Okay.
So you all relaxed and comfy and everything?
Give me a minute or two, I probably will be.
Okay. I know you've heard the expression, be careful what you pray for.
That's right.
You might get it.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talked earlier, you said you had prayed that prayer, and you got what you prayed for. Tell us about that.
Yeah, probably about 2 years ago, I had been really praying to the Lord to just be able to use me, and I didn't care what it looked like. I just wanted him to just use me, however that was. And I prayed for that regularly. And then in a matter of 1 week, I was asked to sing on the worship team. And then a couple days later, I got your letter asking me if I would, share up on the witness stand. So in a matter of a week, he really answered my prayer big time.
So your first response was kind of, uh-oh.
Yeah.
And then you knew that you prayed and you'd asked God to do that, and he was doing it. So
right.
what was your choice?
Well, I knew, since it was so evidently him answering my prayer, that had I said no, I'd be disobedient. So
We're glad you prayed that, and we're glad that
Me
you
too.
Responded. Thank so you. we can hear your story together. So why don't we start with telling us about your early life, where you were born, grew up, and what Heather's life was like in those early years.
Sure. I am one of four children. I have two older brothers and one younger brother, but I didn't really grow up with my two older brothers. They were a lot older than me, but I moved to New York when I was four from New Jersey and started attending Grace right around then, in 1989, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh. Now you've tipped
I'm
your
29.
Hand. See, maybe it wasn't the last witness stand, but maybe the last one of time before, I got a little reprimanding.
I know.
Because
I took you off the hook.
Yeah, I basically made it obvious what the woman's age was, but I made no reference to the man's age. So I basically was confronted with, what was that about?
Yeah.
And I said, I forgot. So I kind of made it a point there not to bring that up. But you brought it up, so that's, I don't have to. So that's great. So you moved up to this area from New York.
From
New Jersey. And you moved to the Stone Ridge
right.
area. And so got involved in the church, and I think you pretty much did the stuff that kids growing up in a church would normally do, right?
Right. We were involved in Sunday schools and camp. I went to Camp Careth for 13 or 14 years, or Cedarbrook, and VBS and all that stuff. Doug and I, my younger brother and I, we would do like normal kid stuff. We'd have our sleepovers and chase groundhogs and swim. We had a normal middle class American lifestyle.
Yes. So you and Doug got along well. I mean, as well as brother and sister, very similar to this.
Well, if you ask my mom, she would have wanted to give us away between 9 and 14. But yeah, we got along really well. We did everything together. We had a lot of the same friends.
Mm-hmm.
Played outside baseball and was just trying to catch animals and
typical stuff for middle class, catching animals.
Yeah, out in Stone Ridge.
Yeah. So I think the the average person would say that you and Doug were good kids.
We were, yeah. We never really got in trouble. We were good students, had a lot of friends, kind of kept busy with wholesome things, and besides our bickering.
Yeah, which is, you know, everybody understands that uh-huh. had at least one sibling.
Right.
They know what that's like. So I know that you had an especially good relationship with your dad. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that in those early years, what it was like.
Yeah, Dad was, he worked from home. Well, he worked for himself, so he didn't always work from home. So, but he was able to be home with us a lot when my mom went back to school. He was Mr. Mom for a long time. He cooked all the time. We used to joke because he was a way better cook than my mom. And my mom won't eat anything besides, like, American food. Mm-hmm. So because of her limited palate, dinners were boring when she was home. But Dad would...
We're not going to tell her that either.
Is this being recorded? I don't know. But Dad was, he took pride in taking care of us, and he would bring us to our sports, and he was a really godly man who would sit us down at the end of the night and read us books. We'd have devotions, and he'd sing to us, even though he wasn't that great at singing. And I don't know.
Yeah, I knew your dad from way back, too, when he was attending the church, and he was fun.
Yeah.
He was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. He was just the genuine article.
Right,
you know,
right.
What you saw with your dad was what you got, and he was just real.
Yeah, so I was asked not too long ago what my dad's hobbies were. Like, how would I explain my dad? And I was like, oh, what are his hobbies? Like, people. Like, that's what he loved, was just people.
Mm-hmm.
He liked, I feel like he could just have a conversation about anything. It could be limited, and it's his capacity, whatever the topic was, but mm-hmm. he just really genuinely wanted to get to know whoever he was talking to at the time.
Yes. And I know he wanted to help people, because even his work was about helping people find meaningful work for them. And I know a big part of it was because of the relational aspect of doing that. So grew up Stone Ridge, normal childhood, brother you got along well with, and special relationship with your dad. And then came those wonderful, very unpredictable high school years.
Right.
So, and I know you got into sports, and you got into a certain kind of crowd. So talk to us about that, and tell us what we need to know. You don't have to tell us what we don't need to know.
Gotcha. When I got to high school, those wholesome friends that I kind of grew up with, we all found our own place. And I was really into sports. Really, I lettered in 4 sports, and that became my life. School no longer meant academics to me. It was more like my sports and my social life. And my social life, turned into this major party scene, and I was, drinking all the time. And it never really affected my sports, so I didn't really think anything of it. And I partied too much and didn't really care where that ended me up, and it didn't really end up well. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So it was, they kind of both reinforced each other. You got into the wrong crowd, and that reinforced the sort of the party life.
Right.
And then the party life reinforced hanging out with those kinds of kids.
Right, it's a vicious circle.
Yeah, and it just escalated.
Right.
Now, I know that you and your brother Doug mm-hmm. had a lot of similar interests. I know you were both wonderful athletes, mm-hmm. and I know Doug ended up getting a scholarship to college. I know I talked to your dad a lot about him because we both played baseball, mm-hmm. and I know he was a good athlete. But one difference between you and Doug was that Doug never kind of fell off the wagon, did he?
No. We were raised in the same home with the same expectations and rules and guidelines, same morals, and but I don't know. He was also a good athlete, and he was friends with the kids that would party on the weekends. Doug never fell off the wagon, like you said. And you know, he'd go to the parties, but he wouldn't drink, or he would make sure he got home early and study. And
isn't that annoying?
Yeah.
Yes. So, similar backgrounds. I mean, very similar backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Both in church, did all the church scene, the camp, the Sunday school, all that. And both became athletes, both good athletes, similar crowds, but somehow he didn't fall into the lifestyle.
Right. Yeah.
He was able to separate himself
right.
from that.
And I couldn't. I didn't. And even though I made a lot of the choices that I made, you know, I always felt guilty about it. I always, like, I was just kind of bogged down with sadness and guilt, and yet I just continued to, you know, go out on the weekends and get drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, but it was kind of like always kind of playing in the background in your mind.
It was, because, you know, I'd still be going to church. I'd still be telling my friends I'm a Christian, and I actually believed what I was saying when I would say Jesus is the Son of God. Mm-hmm. He died on the cross for my sins, and through that I can get to heaven. But I never really repented of that lifestyle or turned from those things. I just continued to do these things, and I don't know.
Yeah.
My conscience you did, was telling me otherwise.
You did what so many men are sort of known for, and that's compartmentalize. You had your spiritual life over here, and that was all taken care of. Because I know that at an early age, you did profess faith in Christ, and that was a very real part of your life. Mm-hmm. But somehow it sort of stayed over here.
Yeah.
And then the other Heather, I don't know if we should say the real Heather or the non-real Heather,
right.
sort of lived in a different world. And the two didn't really coincide so much. So you finished high school, you graduated from high school, and then I know you had some plans, things, something that you had wanted to do was always kind of a life dream of yours.
Yeah, I'd always wanted to fly airplanes. The higher I am, the happier I am still today, altitude-wise.
Yes, thank you. We're so glad you clarified, given what you said before.
Right.
Yes.
So I had anticipated on going to the Air Force, but we had hosted a foreign exchange student when I was a senior in high school, and she was from Spain, and they gave me the same opportunity to live in Spain for a year, so I chose to do that instead, and continued to live the Heather lifestyle over there.
Yes.
For a year.
You know, we had talked earlier, and I went down to visit a friend of mine in North Carolina back in the spring, and I've known them as a couple since high school, and she's a pilot, and she's flown hundreds and hundreds of times. She's actually on a rescue team, and so they knew I was coming down, and they said, "So would you like to go up in the plane?" And I went, "Yeah, sure. Why not? I've never been up in a small plane before." And so I planned to do that. But the weather was really bad that day that we were going to go. And so I didn't know if I was disappointed or elated that I didn't go up in the plane. But the guy, my friend, told me that he was going to have her cut the engine while we're up there because that's so much fun and so exciting. And you then had told me, it is.
It is fun, yeah. I got to go on an airplane ride in an open cockpit biplane. And, the pilot's behind me, so he's like, "Just give me thumbs up if you're having fun, thumbs down if you're not." I'm like, "This is great." And we got to, like, do barrel rolls and loop-de-loops, and he stalled the engine, and all of a sudden it got quiet. And
oh, yeah.
I thought it was great.
Someone's got to do it, I guess. So that's really in your blood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Flying. Okay. So you went over to Spain and spent some time there, and then I think it was after you got back you started dating a particular individual.
I referred to him as my drinking buddy. He was just in the same crowd and started dating this guy who was an unbeliever, who would just go to these parties and kind of hit it off. And he went into the Marine Corps. When he came back from boot camp, he proposed, and I said, yeah, and I was 19 when I said yes. And 20 when I got married.
So the thing that you had most in common was that you were drinking buddies.
Yeah.
That was kind of like...
Yeah, we had the same group of friends. We laughed at the same things. We got along and at the time. And
so you got married at 20. Okay, so you're married, 20 years old, and... how'd that go?
Terrible. It was terrible.
Who knew?
Yeah. Most people, I think. But it was terrible. 9 months into my marriage, let me back it up. I guess he started being very verbally abusive to me, and we would end up fighting, and we didn't really fight when we were dating, and all of a sudden, we were really fighting badly, and I didn't know what to do. I felt kind of trapped, like, what the heck did I sign up for? Mm-hmm. And then one day, we were fighting about something, and he just pinned me to the ground and just punched me. And I needed to wear an appliance in my teeth because, like, he messed up my jaw so bad. And I was pregnant at the time with my son, and I didn't know. So a couple weeks later, I found out that I was pregnant with Austin. And Austin was quite the lifesaver, because, like, literally and spiritually, because I had recognized that, you know, it's not just me anymore. I have this little person that's going to rely on me to, you know, to raise him and to raise him well. I have that responsibility. And, of course, I knew what that meant. So when Austin was born, I got involved in a really great Baptist church down in Virginia where I was living, and got involved in MOPS and started gaining Christian friends, which I really hadn't had in a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So even though the marriage isn't so good, Austin was born, he kind of was a sort of a wake-up call to you that this things aren't right, and then you got involved in a church where you were living, and things went along okay for a while, okay? And
we still continued to fight. He was just nasty, I don't know. And... you know, I would take weekend trips up here because I knew that our marriage was just horrific. And I would take weekend trips up to New York with Austin and kind of get away from it all, clear my head. And, you know, it was just a quick break from
the stress and the turmoil and all that.
Yeah, to say the least. And, you know, one time I was up here and my neighbor told me that he was having girls over, and I had found out one time that he was actually... you know, having the affair. So I'm like, so I decided, you know, it was then that I needed to leave, and I did. But then I found myself 24, divorced, and a single mom.
Yeah. And at that point, Austin was still very young.
Little.
Yeah. So now, was it about this time when your dad started getting sick? Around that time?
Maybe no.
A little after that?
A little after that.
Okay. Why don't we move up to there? Why don't you tell us about that? I mean, many people here knew your dad, but so it was probably maybe in 2009, 10?
10, I would say. I mean, he had two aneurysms behind his knees that in 2007 that were taken care of, and... things were kind of quiet for a while, but then he started having leg pain again, and the doctors said it was another aneurysm and DVT, and it needed to be evacuated and all that stuff. So they were treating him for that and never biopsied it. he actually also had shoulder problems. So when he got his shoulder x-ray, it was a secondary find on the shoulder x-ray that he had all these nodules on his lungs. Mm-hmm. And it was from that that they determined that he had soft tissue sarcoma that started in his leg and had metastasized to his lungs. Mm-hmm.
And if they had known, it may have been treated differently, I would assume.
It's an aggressive cancer. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we may have had to take, like, extreme means to keep him around, like an amputation or something, but yep. It was possible. Mm-hmm. Yep. But it was unfortunate that they continued to treat him for DVTs and not biopsy it and find out that it was cancer earlier.
Yeah. Okay. So now you began attending Grace Church again in 2010. I mean, obviously, you grew up here, so uh-huh. You were very familiar with the church, but then you hadn't been here even in the area for a while. But then in 2010, you started coming back to the church as an adult, as a single mom with a young son. So, and you found yourself growing pretty fast.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I started coming probably at the end of 2009, actually, and but periodically, and it wasn't until 2010 that I was just coming regularly. It actually happened. I was driving on Hurley Mountain Road, actually. I remember exactly where I was, and a Casting Crown song came on east to west, and one of the lines in that song said, "You're not holding on. I'm not holding on to you, but you're holding on to me." And it just hit me, you know, because up until then I was still, you know, I had new friends at my new job, and I was finding myself, whenever I'd hang out with the girls, I was having a couple too much, you know, too many drinks, and I was still finding myself doing that. And then I heard this song, and I'm like, what am I doing? So I always paint this picture of how I felt during this time where I wasn't making wise choices, was... I felt like I was on a leash, that he would only let me go so far, and then I'd feel like this tug, mm-hmm. saying, like, what are you doing? That's enough. You know, he was gracious enough to allow me to make these choices, and through these choices, I'm able to, you know, do things like this and share my story and how God's worked in my life. And those bad choices can turn out to be okay, but at that moment, I just felt like I needed to just really just leave that life and just be a committed follower of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to sob in the car. I just started to just break down and just repent and ask God to really just forgive me and take me in. And that's when I started to grow, and I started to come back to church regularly, and I got involved in the growth groups and started really gaining a lot of Christian friends. And
mm-hmm. And in 2011, you were even baptized.
I was, and my dad was too sick at that time to come. But it was videotaped, and we were able to share that with them. And I did on September 17th, I think. 4th. September 4th. Mm-hmm. I was baptized.
Yes. You know, I think that was the year we had, like, three rainouts.
Cancellations, I know. I was worried about the temperature of the pool.
Oh, yeah. I don't ever remember any of the picnics being canceled, and it was canceled twice. Wasn't that Sandy? Was that Hurricane Sandy, I think?
2011.
Yeah. Okay. And I know Bob was videotaping the baptisms, and little did we know that it would be so meaningful
right.
for your dad, because
right.
he could not make it, and yet he was able to see it, and we got the audio, and
right.
he could hear your testimony and everything, so that was great.
Yeah.
But then on November 5th, 2011, you lost your dad.
Yeah, but you know what, leading up to his death, I actually left a good job in Woodstock as a dental assistant to stay home with him. So I was fortunate enough to spend the last 5 or 6 months with him, mm-hmm. and I became his caregiver, which was strange. I'd just stopped cutting up Austin's food, and now I'm cutting up my dad's food. But it was a true blessing to be able to be with him. He, knowing that pretty much death was inevitable in the near future, he just maintained his faith through the whole thing. He was, I mean, his Bible was open all day, and through tears he would read it, and his pages were just stained. Don't do that. I would cry too. he found joy in his suffering, knowing that when he would depart from this body, he would be present with the Lord. And he knew that was a better place to be. And so we were able to spend a lot of time just being in that moment together. And he would really help me grow. And just seeing his example, you know, as I started really coming back to the Lord and trying to just follow Jesus. Dad was a great example of that. He really was. He was always in prayer. And, you know, it was cute because he had his laptop. He did everything from his laptop. He wasn't very mobile towards the end of his life. And every morning at 9 o'clock, it would pop up and it would say, "Rejoice in the Lord." That's like, it was a reminder every day. Just, and that, whatever that looked like. And he had a long list of people to pray for. So even though he was dying actively, he was still...
And he knew it. He knew it.
He knew it, right? He would still just be praying for others and finding scheduling time to just, you know, spend time with the Lord. And it was neat to watch.
So he had that, conflict, that inner conflict between... Because he was suffering, because he was in pain, because he was so miserable in that way physically, recognizing that he could be released from that and kind of wanting to be released from that, and yet not wanting to leave his family and friends and this life behind.
Right. He was sad. I mean, he knew that he'd be missing a lot. Doug just got married. So, I mean, that was kind of tough. Because, you know, he knew that those types of things he would miss out on.
Yes.
So it was hard for him, but there was just so much joy and peace knowing that he's been redeemed. And that, you know, when he does take his final breath, that this body is just temporary and then he'll be at home with the Lord.
Yeah. So... kind of back to your situation more personally, I heard you say that, you've heard me say, the Bible teaches, of course, and now you're saying that you've come to understand that sanctification is a process.
Right.
That it's not something that happens instantly because you've made a commitment, a decision. You made that a long time ago, and yet you knew that you weren't really being sanctified, and then you went to this church back in Virginia, and you kind of your faith was rekindled, but the fire didn't really catch.
Mm-hmm.
And then you came back here and got involved, but it is a process, isn't it?
It is, like you said, salvation is just it's a moment's decision, and it's available to, you know, anybody who just recognizes that Jesus is the Son of God,
mm-hmm.
died on the cross for our sins. And by grace through faith, we can be saved. And that decision to follow Jesus is momentary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. But the sanctification process is all the time. And I sang a song a couple months ago, like, "The more I seek you, the more I find you."
Mm-hmm.
And the process of just being in the Word, seeking God, following His commands, serving, just keeping your eyes fixed on Him, that's just it's an amazing process. I'm blown away all the time by how evident God is in every little detail of my life, because I'm seeking after Him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, to me the analogy is inescapable, but oftentimes we miss it. So when we're born physically, it's instantaneous. I mean, you know, it can be a few hours, but for all intents and purposes, it's very quick and it's instantaneous, and you're either born or you're not. But then there's life, and no one would say 5 minutes after they've been born, well, you know, my life is pretty much over. No, your life is just starting. But somehow we tend to miss it in the spiritual life, that people put so much emphasis on that moment of decision. And that's a very important thing. It's a very important moment when a person recognizes that they're a sinner and condemned and they need a Savior. Very, very important. But that's just the beginning. Sanctification is for the rest of their life.
Right.
And you know that now in ways that you didn't know before. And you had said that so many of the things that you love now, you used to hate, and so many of the things that you hate now, you used to love.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, I find myself things that I used to find acceptable or okay, or things I actually did, I despise. Like, it makes me sick. I hate it. Mm-hmm. And things that I would deliberately ignore, I just run to, and I have like insatiable desire to just need to be in the Word, be in prayer, be in fellowship, and serve. It's like never ending.
Yes. Which was not there before. And you had said, obviously no one here is going to think that now that you're never enticed by sin anymore. But you would say that the difference is now there's a clear, undeniable attraction to what God wants for you.
Right.
To the righteousness that He desires in your life. And of course, now we're back to sanctification again.
That's right.
And aren't we? Okay. So can you leave us anything to ponder that really comes out of your own experience, your own life experience? I think maybe a question to help you focus on that would be, What has made the difference? Because you've been a believer since you were a child, and you know that was real. That really happened. So, what's the difference? What's different now than all of those years when you were a believer? What do you think?
How my life looks different?
Yeah. What's different about the fact that you're now really on the road to sanctification? While before you kind of like missed the turn.
Well, I think there was that moment where I just needed to leave that lifestyle of sin. And so, like, where the road forks, you know, I just kind of kept my eyes fixed on Jesus. And you're right. Like, I, you know, sin is not, I'm not void of sin. But I hate sin and I try to avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
But like you were saying when we were talking, like the trajectory of my life is completely different now, and just so much better, and I just, I don't know.
Yeah, your experiences will be different because you're on a different path than you were before, and you know, the philosopher long time ago, and many people heard this by Pascal, who said that in every human heart is a God-shaped vacuum, and we're restless until we find our rest in Him. Mm-hmm. So even all those years when you were having an enjoyable time and it seemed like that was your life, there was this kind of nagging void.
Yeah.
And you eventually let God take, you know, that void that existed,
right.
And it was there all the time. And from time to time, you were reminded that
often
it was there.
Often I was reminded, yeah. And I just didn't care. My social life was just too important to me at the time. But I knew all along, and I finally just surrendered.
Yes, you surrendered. That, and that was the key. You finally surrendered. So you like every human being, has this God-shaped vacuum, and Jesus Christ has filled that vacuum. And
amazing grace.
Yes, and that's made all the difference.
It has.
It is making all the difference.
Right.
Great. So we thank you for sharing your story. Can we thank her a little more verbally, audibly?